In this episode of our CF podcast, Ideas in the Spotlight, we will talk about enablement and plausibility in the US and Europe, key takeaways from the Amgen versus Sanofi US Supreme Court decision, and the EPO Enlarged Board of Appeals ruling in G2 of 21. This episode of our podcast is based on the CF webinar that my US colleague CJ Moore from McBee Moore Vanek IP and I held on October 26,
2023. CF Podcast. Ideas in the Spotlight. Essential and up-to-date information on the protection of ideas and innovations.
Welcome to today's CF webinar on enablement and plausibility in the US and at the EPO. And I'm very happy that I have with me here today CJ Moore, partner and patent attorney at the US life science boutique patent law firm McBee Moore and Vanek IP. Many of you know CJ and Susan McBee from perhaps client work or other means, but we certainly appreciate a longstanding working relationship with them. And CJ will present the Amgen Sanofi Supreme Court case. I don't know, CJ, you might also want to introduce yourself briefly, but without further ado, I would say I hand over to you. And then, yeah, we will see kind of the parallel situation in Europe then afterwards that I will present.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to present today. It's a real pleasure to be here with you and to be able to present on this case to all of you. As Natalie mentioned, I'm with the law firm of McBee, Moore & Vanek. We are in the greater Washington, D.C. area. We focus on chemistry and biotechnology types of patents. And my background specifically is in neuroscience. So I have a fair bit of experience in cell and molecular biology. So this particular line of cases is rather interesting to me professionally. We see a lot of things like this. So with that, I'll just launch into the presentation. So this is a case that has there are a number of Amgen cases that relate to a lot of these topics. So this has been in the courts for many years now. And this latest one that I'm going to talk about today was decided about 5 months ago by the Supreme Court. So I'm going to discuss briefly what was going on with all of these cases and give an overview of the decision, but also talk about how we think about enablement issues now in the United States and hopefully provide some useful touch points for you if you're facing an enablement type of decision. So whether you're drafting an application or whether you're dealing with enablement rejections. So this is a case where we're dealing with enablement, and the Supreme Court decided that these claims in Amgen's patents were not enabled. So the specification, the disclosure did not enable the skilled artisan to make and use the claimed invention. So this particular case is about enablement. An earlier one, though, is about written description. So this line of cases implicates our Section 112, so written description and enablement. So it is important to note that this case does not really set out a new test or standard. This is relying on the old standards that we've gotten used to, but it provides a little bit more explanation of how to think about it and maybe how to navigate this. So importantly, when you're responding to an enablement rejection or drafting an application, it's useful to think about what the claims are really going after. So how broad are they? Because if they're very, very broad, then you have to enable more. You have to describe better how to get there. So next, let's go to the procedural history. So this particular case is about two Amgen patents. And the independent claims are summarized here. And what I want you to note is that the claims are very similar. These are in the same family of patents. So the claims don't recite any structure, which is interesting. It's interesting now in 2023. Note that the claims issued in 2014. So at that time, claims like this were just fine at the patent office. So you could recite things like this, an antibody that when it has this particular activity, it does something else, right? So an antibody that binds to an antigen. Now, that worked in 2014 and before that. There is a later case in this same line that caused the USPTO to change its whole approach to antibody claims. And I'll get to that in a moment. But I want to point out here that we only have functional language in these claims, as shown in the boldface type. So that's very interesting now, looking at it in 2023. In 2014, this was completely normal. And I've spoken with examiners former examiners who've said, yeah, this was completely normal then, and I would allow a claim like this all the time. So the first district court case was in 2014, and the issues were obviousness and infringement. So written description and enablement were not at issue at that point. So in 2014, the first district court, they decided that, you know, the claims were not obvious, and the jury decided the patents were valid. On appeal to the Federal Circuit agreed with the non-obviousness grounds, but they remanded and reversed, and that was based on written description and enablement. So they identified 112 issues. And now in the second district court case, it was determined that the Amgen claims lacked enablement. And there was a fair bit of guidance from the USPTO at that point, and that guidance also pointed out the need to enable the full scope of the claimed inventions. So that's an important point with these kinds of claims. What is the full scope of the claimed invention? And then what is the guidance provided by the disclosure? And then based on those two things, a comparison between the full scope and the guidance in the disclosure, how much more is needed? How much experimentation might be needed to go from what's disclosed to what is claimed? And here, it was decided that the Amgen claims need substantial experimentation. And it's this 2017 case that led the USPTO to clarify in a memo the written description requirement for antibody claims. So it's at that point that claims like we have here, where you only have functional language and no structure, it's at that point that we all had to change our tactics and start describing antibodies based on structure instead of function, instead of only function. So now back to the Federal Circuit, they decided, yes, the claims are not enabled, and there's undue experimentation. And they called attention there to the functional language in the claims. And that they pointed out, when you have that functional language, that raises the bar for enablement. So from a practical matter, that is very interesting. And I've had numerous discussions with examiners about this same point. If all you have in the claim is structural language, then it's a fairly simple analysis. But if you now have functional language in there as well, the question is, well, does all of this structure that you're covering have that same function that you're requiring? So you have to now put the two of those things together, structure plus function. So it can cause problems for you. So now, since we're in an enablement type of a situation, we need to discuss how in the United States we think about the enablement questions. You know, how do we show enablement? And that brings us to an older case called In Re Wands and the Wands factors in that case. So it's a fairly well-known case, and these are the general factors from the case that whenever we get a rejection based on enablement, these are the things cited back to us as being analyzed. And here, it is these ones that are shown in orange that the Federal Circuit was really zeroing in on. Okay, so we're looking at how broad are these claims, how predictable is it in this particular art, how much direction is provided in the specification, and how much experimentation would be needed to get to that full scope of the claims. So again, we've got the breadth of the claims. They decided it was very, very broad. They looked at how predictable this field is, but I want you to notice that the things that they were focused on here dealt with structure and not function. So we're talking about translating a sequence and how it's not possible to get to a 3D structure, focusing on substitutions in the amino acid sequence. That, again, wasn't in the claims. So in some ways, these claims are a victim of how times have changed and how our approach to these kinds of inventions has changed. So again, this graphic now shows roughly how the courts are thinking about these kinds of issues. If you've got a specification and you've got a certain amount that is enabled, and that doesn't necessarily match with the claim scope, the question is it predictable to get to that full claim scope? Is it reasonable, the amount of experimentation needed to get to that full claim scope? And here, as far as the specification guidance and the experimentation needed, the Federal Circuit decided there was really no guidance beyond the 26 working examples that Amgen gave. And the only other way to find them were with trial and error and de novo discovery through their roadmap. And they decided with all of these methods that Amgen said could be used would require an unreasonable amount of time and effort. So if you're drafting an application or if you're dealing with an enablement rejection, it can be useful to consider this and think about how you would rebut these kinds of arguments, how you would say that or be able to show that there is predictability and I have provided guidance and the amount of experimentation is not unreasonable. So on appeal to the Supreme Court, we had these two questions, and it was this particular question that was granted cert. So the question being whether the specification has to enable those skilled in the art to reach the full scope of the claimant embodiments without undue experimentation. Now, interestingly, this question too essentially paraphrases the patent office's own explanation of the critical questions for enablement. So that is whether the specification provides enough information for the skilled artisan to make and use the full scope of the claimed invention without undue experimentation. But, you know, this part here, whether they have to cumulatively identify and make all or nearly all embodiments of the invention without substantial time and effort, is an interesting take on the requirement. And it goes back to the give and take between the amount of disclosure versus the amount that is claimed. How close do you have to get? How much guidance do you have to provide? And so that's really where this argument was. So before the Supreme Court, Amgen argued that its patents provide a rich handbook and a wealth of information about the claimed antibodies, and that a skilled artisan could follow the patent's step-by-step roadmap. Now, unfortunately, I think that some of this explanation or simplification may have pointed out some of the deficits in these claims, especially considering how we look at antibody type claims at this point. And I'll explain a little more of that later. But the Supreme Court came back and said, no, these claims are much, much broader than those 26 antibodies. And they pointed out that the claim potentially covers millions of antibodies, but they've only disclosed 26. So they also pointed out that there is no limit to any particular structure here. And when dealing with these with an examiner, for instance, we often get pushback from the examiner saying that that immediately raises a concern whether the scope of the enablement in your disclosure is commensurate with the claims, because the claims potentially have no limit on in certain dimensions. And so that really raises a red flag with examiners. So if you're drafting an application, it can be very, very useful to think about that and maybe have that discussion with an inventor to flesh things out a little further. So we can see from the kinds of responses that the Supreme Court gave, they were thinking about the claims more like this. So the enablement more like this orange little bit here, and the scope of the claims much, much broader. And then the question is, well, how am I going to get from this enabled scope down here out to the full scope of the claim? We don't know. The court said these are really just two research assignments. So they noted that Amgen is admitting that it was trying to claim an entire universe of antibodies, the antibodies that had these the particular function in the claim. And the court disagreed. They said, look, the only way to do this is to create a wide range of candidate antibodies and screen. So the only way to do this based on Amgen's disclosure. And the other being to take the 26 that were provided and then make substitutions and then test them. And now I kind of think that the roadmap language in the arguments may have worked a little bit against Amgen at this point, because if you take that step-by-step roadmap analogy a little bit further, it's almost as if they have said, we're claiming all of the cities in Europe that, you know, have a particular feature, and they have taught how to get to 26 of those cities. But that map that they've provided in their specification doesn't show roads to anything but those 26 cities. And they don't show any direction how to get to any of those other cities. It's just known that they're out there somewhere. And so the only way to get there would be to get in your car and drive. So the analogy kind of works against them at a certain level. But the court pointed out that they're not saying that you have to disclose every single embodiment within a claim in order for the specification to be enabling. So that is not the question. The court pointed out that it could be useful to provide or describe some general quality running through the class that gives it a particular or peculiar fitness for the particular purpose. So they really leave the door open for how you would do that. They're not going to tell anybody how to draft the claims. They don't want to be boxed into that either. But when you're responding to a rejection or drafting an application, this can be useful to keep in mind. What are the general qualities of these things, whatever it is that I'm trying to claim, whether it's an antibody, whether it's a solenoid, anything, any particular thing that you're describing broadly, and you have multiple different things that you're trying to claim in there, in that genus, what are the common things that tie those things together? The court also pointed out that not all of the experimentation would be unreasonable. The issue is that the more you claim, the more you have to enable, and you have to think back too on what is common in the art. If it's common to take a sequence and then just vary all of the possible amino acids in that sequence and then test them all, if that's common in the art, then okay, that would be an argument you could use when rebutting an enablement rejection or an enablement challenge. But here, that is not the case. So that kind of an approach doesn't work. So you have to then think about how you'd rebut all of those WANS factors with this kind of a situation. And remember, if you're claiming more, you have to enable more, not just describe, but enable it. So then the question is, how does this affect things going forward? The USPTO has said that they're going to issue new guidance that's currently pending, at least as of a few days ago. We also know that there is a great deal of diversity at the Patent Office in terms of what they will allow. However, they generally will not allow any kind of a claim like this anymore, at least not since 2017 or so, and definitely not since 2018 in the new USPTO guidance about written description. So there, that is why we now have to recite structure when we're reciting antibody claims. And there, now we generally recite CDRs, complementarity determining regions, in antibody claims. And then some examiners allow variability around those things as well. But back to this point, it's useful, at least for the USPTO, to do a little bit of digging about how your examiner behaves and see what they might do, and definitely talk to them if it looks beneficial to talk to them. Have an examiner interview. So just to summarize a little bit about where things were with the Amgen-Sanofi type of claims. So it's like we had 26 different antibodies, and there's a reasonable zone of enablement around each one. You could extend it a bit, say based on conservative substitutions of particular regions. And then there was maybe a general quality running through that class of 26 antibodies. And so that extended this enablement cloud a bit further. The problem, though, was that the full scope of the claim was much, much broader, in the minds of the Supreme Court at least, much broader than was enabled by this specification. So to avoid this kind of a situation, it could be useful to expand this zone that you have enabled. So if you can find some sort of a general quality that runs through the class, then you could conceivably expand it, argue that you have expanded it, argue that these have this common thread. And so you don't have to argue nearly so much distance between this scope of enablement and the scope of the claim. It could make things a lot easier for you, maybe. So the way that could work is, and this is the way we approach things now, we define antibodies and other binding type molecules by their structure. For antibodies in particular, we claim according to CDRs, we claim according to structure. Now, every case is different. It depends on prior art, what's known about the different CDRs, the combinations of CDRs, things like that. But this is essentially how we start to approach these kinds of claims. What is the structure, and how far can we vary that structure and keep the particular function, whether it's binding a particular thing or whether it's blocking something else? It all turns on the structure. Now, we can maybe claim all six CDRs with the exact sequence, all six, and have some variation within the CDRs, some sort of a homology cloud, or omitting potentially a CDR as well. It's good to have various ways of claiming this, describe this in different ways in the specifications so we can claim it differently and just test the examiner, see what they might allow, what art they find, and preserve your options. But generally, we end up with claims that look a bit like this. So we have the CDRs directed to a particular sequence, and if we can, we would like to omit functional language. It's not always necessary, but that kind of language invites the examiner also to ask, does every single one of your antibodies that you're claiming, every one of these things, have this function? And so if you're claiming a lot of function, if your function is very broad, now your structure, the structure that you've described, it also has to be broad to encompass that function. We have faced many times where the examiner has asked, I don't know whether all of your structures have this function, but if you get rid of that function, then potentially I will allow that claim. It's very interesting. And finally, we advise planning your fallback positions. So as in two slides ago, we had pointed out how the CDRs can be varied. Maybe omit one of the CDRs, add variable regions or not, and recite methods of preparing and using all of the usual things that you might do with any kind of an application. Just think about the fallback positions in case your preferred method of approaching the invention won't work. But just because this is not working in the United States to claim an antibody based only on functional language doesn't mean you shouldn't describe it according to that or try to claim it only by functional language around the world. Because, for instance, in Japan, as we understand it, claims with broad functional language will still work. That may change. You might find that it goes the Amgen route in the future, but currently, as we understand it, that sort of an approach will still work. And with that, I will open it up for questions.
Yes, thank you very much, CJ. Are there any questions from the participants? If so, please enter them into the Q&A box. And while you're doing that, I have a general question and a more specific one. The general maybe is if you could maybe just briefly explain if there's a real difference or what the line is between enablement and written description, because I often note it kind of used often together. It's, yes. I think to many of us, not clear if it's a distinctive legal concept or if the written description requirement is kind of a subspecies of the enablement requirement, but maybe you can give some guidance on that, how your understanding is there.
No, that's a very good question, and we often get the two rejections together. So the office will usually pair an enablement rejection and a written description rejection together. Now, in the United States, overcoming a written description rejection can be fairly straightforward because we're looking for literal language in the specification, literal words. And we can take it a little bit broader from that also. So what are the teachings suggested from that? But it's at that point that we're starting to get into the enablement type questions. So when you're making a subjective interpretation, you're starting to move into enablement territory. So in the United States, the examiners generally take a very broad view of written description, different from what you would face in Europe, where you might be tied to the literal language much more tightly. Mm-hmm. So in the United States, if you have a description of some element in one part of the specification, and you have a description of another element in another part of the specification, it is okay to join them and point to that. Whereas in Europe, for instance, it's much more difficult to break apart a Marcuse grouping. But in the United States, we can break apart a Marcouche grouping at will. It's very easy. Enablement, much more subjective, and the questions being, have you provided instructions for reaching that full scope without undue experimentation? And so I think that is where the real difficulty lies, because it is more subjective.
Yeah. Okay, we also have one question from Stefan Kutik. Thank you, Stefan, for that. And that is what the implications of the Amgen-Sanofi ruling are beyond antibody claims, so also beyond biology. Are there learnings for chemical inventions, for example, as well? What is about Marcouche formulae, broad Marcouche groups? What are your thoughts there?
I mean, it is one patent law. So what works or what would be applied in one technological field should also be applied in any other field. So, for example, the patent office has guidance on enablement for computer-related inventions or mechanical-type inventions. So it does translate from one field to the other. It just depends on the kind of a question that comes up. So if you describe a particular structure or a particular thing in your claim, and you're trying to get to all of the things that might have this particular property, like say a solenoid that does a particular thing, or a small molecule that does a particular thing, treats a particular disease, then you can't simply say, I claim all of the things that have this particular function. You have to provide structure. Yeah. And with chemical inventions, that's usually done with the different R groups and the different elements that could populate that R group.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, we will see how the case law develops. I also think a lot of patent practitioners, also examiners, probably think that the ruling is a bit far going from the Supreme Court. So who knows? Maybe the following case law will limit it a bit to this specific aspect of defining antibodies by epitopes, which of course is a very, very broad claim that you get then. Yeah, but thank you for that. I think further question we can also take in the joint discussion later. But then thank you, CJ. And I would then switch to the European situation and also just share my presentation with you. I hope you now see the slides. Yeah. And maybe just as a general comment, switching now to the situation before the EPO, my presentation will focus on the G2 of 21 decision from the Enlarged Board of Appeal on plausibility. As you will see, the decision itself is actually about plausibility in the context of inventive step. But we grouped these two presentations together because this question of plausibility in Europe also often arises under sufficiency of disclosure. So that's why it's highly relevant also to the question of enablement and sufficiency of disclosure. Regarding the specific type of claim that CJ just talked about in the Amgen-Sanofi case, there, following now the Supreme Court ruling, there's a real divergence across the jurisdictions, because such functional antibody claims in Europe, at least from an enablement perspective, do not pose a challenge. So they are usually antibody claims that define antibodies by epitopes are considered sufficiently disclosed and enabled, because the EPO considers it more or less a routine practice for skilled persons to generate antibodies based on antigens. There, at the EPO, such claims, however, are also rarely granted, but there the reason for not granting such claims is the breadth of the claims under inventive step, right? Because you're usually then not the first. And that's why in Europe also a lot of antibody claims need to be narrowed down to the specific CDRs. But the reason for that is not so much enablement. It's usually inventive step, and that you need to show a special technical effect for then your sub-selection of antibodies, and that the EPO then only considers credibly demonstrated for a certain subset of the antibodies. Okay, but then let's turn to this presentation, maybe just by way of introduction, a little bit about the European standard of sufficiency. of disclosure, and that's founded in Article 83 EPC, yeah, that the European patent application shall disclose the invention in a manner sufficiently clear and complete for it to be carried out by a person skilled in the art. The founding principle is the quid pro quo principle, or what's sometimes also called the patent bargain, that you as an applicant gain 20 years of monopoly, but in exchange, you also need to advance the state of the art by actually disclosing an enabled invention. Yeah, and that's why we have this requirement in most legal systems in the world. As you may have noticed, Article 83 EPC does not say anything about plausibility, and in fact, the European patent law is silent on this term. However, it's like an elephant in the room. It comes across in a lot of patent cases in Europe. It's a concept developed by the case law and is especially prominent in UK patent litigation, where plausibility is really dealt with like a criterion of its own sort. Yeah, there's no expert spaces in the EPC. It usually surfaces in discussions of enablement, so Article 83 EPC or inventive step. And the diverging line, whether you discuss plausibility under inventive step or sufficiency of disclosure, is whether the technical effect, that where the plausibility is in question, whether that is recited as a feature in the claim or not. And the best example, and I will get to that, are second medical use claims or medical use claims where the therapeutic treatment, so therapeutic efficacy, is a feature in the claim. And there, for example, the question of whether the application as filed renders the therapeutic effect plausible is then a question under Article 83 EPC. The background of this criterion, or why was plausibility at all introduced into European case law, is in principle to avoid speculative patents. Also with this patent bargain in mind, that a patent proprietor should only be able to rely on technical effects that he or she disclosed in the application, or that the application as filed at least renders plausible. And this whole question about plausibility is really highly relevant to life sciences and pharma cases in particular, which heavily rely on data and special technical effects. And in the past has also really led to the revocation of a lot of very important patents. A prime example of this that really kicked off also, again, a very intense discussion of whether the plausibility standard is justified was the so-called Dasatinib case, which is a compound patent. So a claim one to a genus of compounds. It protected the active ingredient of Bristol-Myers Squibb's approved drug product, Sprycel, so Dasatinib as active compound. And here the application as filed was directed to this large group of compounds, which were phosphatyrosine kinase inhibitors, allegedly, but it didn't include real experimental data showing this, but only prophetic examples of possible assays that could be used to test the compounds. And here, although it was a compound claim, the Board of Appeal revoked the patent for lack of inventive step, because the application as filed would not make it plausible that each and every one of those compounds, or specifically also Dasatinib, which was also claimed in an auxiliary request, then in a picture type claim where really only the single compound was claimed, the application as filed would not make it plausible that this compound had the claimed technical effect. So was a phosphatyrosine kinase inhibitor. And that's why post-published data, and there, of course, was a wealth of post-published data showing that it was a phosphatyrosine kinase inhibitor and a very successful one, one that also was approved by the regulatory authorities. All of this could not be taken into account. And here it was dealt with under inventive step, but there's actually a parallel Dasatinib case where the claim is worded as a medical use claim. So, for example, for the treatment of cancer, there then exactly the same question comes up under sufficiency of disclosure, because then, or enablement, then the question is whether the application as filed renders credible or allows the skilled person to achieve the technical effect, renders it plausible that already at the filing date of the application, the applicant was, so to say, in the possession of the invention, So at least had plausible data or data rendering it plausible that the therapeutic utility will be there. And this line of case law requiring plausibility from the application as filed actually really puts pharmaceutical companies into a very difficult position, because there are certain types of claims like dosage regimen claims or second medical use claims where in effect you require clinical trial data to render this particular aspect plausible. But on the other hand, due to publication requirements, especially the clinical trial registers like clinicaltrial.gov, before you can start with such clinical trials, you need to register them on these registries. They get published and then are prior art against your patent applications. So that's a real difficulty, yeah, that you would need to file earlier in order to avoid that prior art. On the other hand, the EPO wants to see a lot of data in the application in these second medical use or dosage regimen cases. Yeah, and that's a real catch-22 situation, which we see pretty often actually in opposition proceedings. And these cases are very difficult. They're not impossible to win. And we just recently had a case where we successfully argued then lack of reasonable expectation of success despite such a clinical trial disclosure of the identical claimed subject matter. And that was successful. But usually I would say in 95% of these cases, the patents are then revoked due to these clinical trial disclosures. But that's maybe a topic for a different seminar. Yeah. Let's turn to G2 of 21. So as I said, this whole plausibility issue was a super, or still is a super hot topic in the field, and everybody waited for the G2 of 21 decision. If you actually read the decision, then I put here two quotes from that I found quite telling. Here's one from the Kluver patent blog: plausibility in G2 of 21 has the elephant left the room. Because if you read the decision, at some instances, it sounds as if, yeah, there wouldn't really be such a big problem with plausibility, while actually the cases, or if you are one of those patentees that lost the patent, you wouldn't consider it no big deal. And the other one here of the head of IP Syngenta Crop Protection, which was one of the parties to the referral proceedings, said the decision is like the Oracle of Delphi. You read it the way you want to understand it. And as you will see, it leaves a lot of room for interpretation and arguments. And I think this was also deliberate on the side of the enlarged board. The underlying case in G2 of 21 is not an antibody case, but actually a crop science case, a case concerning a combination claim, as we see it pretty often in crop science cases, that we have synergistic mixtures of known compounds. The patent proprietor was Sumitomo Chemical Company, the opponent Syngenta. And the claim was directed to this combination of tiamitoxam and then a Marcouche type compound, a second compound defined by a Marcouche formula. And the technical effect of this combination was to be particularly effective against moths, so anti-insecticides. In the first instance, the opposition was rejected. And on appeal, the questions of plausibility arose in the context of whether or not post-filed data can be taken into account. And here is maybe just a quick synopsis. The patent application as filed, and therefore also the patent, comprised data that showed a synergistic effect of certain claimed compounds against two particular moth species. But this was then opposed by data of the opponent, post-published data that, yeah, showed no synergistic effect. So there was a data against data situation. The patentee then filed further post-published evidence, so an experimental report showing a synergistic effect against a third moth species. So this is the experimental report D21. And it was exactly the question whether this experimental report D21 could be admitted into the proceedings or not. And this, in the view of the board, depended on the question whether the synergistic effect against this third moth species was rendered plausible by the application as filed. And here it was clear that if that, that really the case hinged on that decision, because the board, the referring board already noted that if D21 was taken into account, because the opponent didn't submit any counter examples with respect to this third moth species, then the inventive step rejection would fail and an inventive step would be acknowledged, with the particular technical effect being synergism against this third moth species. While if the data cannot be taken into account, then no special technical effect would be recognized. And in these combination cases, it is mostly the case that as soon as the objective technical problem is only the provision of an alternative formulation, that you lose on inventive steps. So for the combination cases, you are really dependent on establishing a special technical effect, in particular synergism between a synergy between the two compounds you're claiming. Right. So the referring board chairman was Mr. Müller, who really likes to to structure things based on legal subcategories or principles. Did a very thorough analysis of the EPO plausibility case law to date, and he identified or bucket sorted these decisions into three groups. And that's why he referred then questions to the enlarged board. And the three groups he identified was, on the one hand, the ab initio plausibility standard, an ab initio implausibility standard, and decisions that didn't apply any plausibility standard to the question of whether post-published evidence could be taken into account. And the ab initio plausibility standard, that means that you would need to show that ab initio, so from the start of the proceedings and the application is filed, renders the technical effect plausible. And here the burden of proof would be on the patent proprietor to demonstrate. So every time you rely on a special technical effect, you as a patent proprietor would need to demonstrate plausibility. The other line of case law, ab initio implausibility, kind of leads to a reversal of the burden of proof. There you would have a situation like plausibility by default. So per se, the patent was granted or the application filed, you consider it in principle plausible. Then the opponent would need to raise implausibility attacks that ab initio there would have been implausibility. And then the no plausibility standard is I think clear. You also don't have to keep that too much in mind, because actually, as you will see, the enlarged board rejected this three bucket principle and rather considers all decisions as being common. Here are the three referral questions that were referred to the enlarged board of appeal. The question one was, should an exception to the principle of free evaluation of evidence be accepted in that post-published evidence must be disregarded on the ground that the proof of the effect rests exclusively on the post-published evidence? And here what bothered the board, or what is problematic in these cases, that you end up with a situation. So if you reject such post-published evidence, which is usually filed by the patentee, then you have a situation where the opponent can rely on post-published evidence. So he can file with his opposition an experimental report that he had performed for the purpose of the opposition proceedings, while the patentee could not defend himself kind of with the same type of experimental report, because on the side of the patentee, one would then say, no, sorry, you cannot rely on post-published data. So that's kind of against this equal arms principle. So that's behind this first question. And then the questions two and three then relate to the plausibility standard to be applied. And the reasoning of the enlarged board in the G2 of 21 decision has five important elements, which I list out here, and we'll just briefly present a slide each on these. And the first one is regards the principle of free evaluation of evidence. Here, the board of appeal, the enlarged board, not unsurprisingly, confirmed that the principle of free evaluation of evidence is a universally applicable principle at the EPO, and then also formulated what then also became the first headnote of the decision, that evidence submitted by a patent applicant or proprietor to prove an technical effect may not be disregarded solely on the ground that such evidence on which the effect rests had not been public before the filing date of the patent in suit. So that's already good. So no, I mean, that would have been really shocking, I think, if the enlarged board would have said, per se, you were not allowed to rely on post-published evidence. Interestingly, yeah, in something like an obiter dicta or so, the enlarged board, with reference to the burden of proof in the problem solution approach, clarified something that wasn't 100% clear from the case law before, and that is who actually bears the burden of proof for the technical effect, which should be separated from the question of plausibility, right? Plausibility is whether you are allowed to bring in data at all, and this burden of proof then plays a role if the data is brought in when judging the data and there are discrepancies, who carries the burden of proof. But there, the enlarged board said that according to, in their opinion, the established case law, the burden of proof rests with the patent applicant or proprietor to properly demonstrate that the purported advantages of the claimed invention have successfully been achieved. So that's certainly interesting for opposition cases, this clarification that the burden of proof so clearly rests with the patentee. Then regarding the concept of plausibility, here the enlarged board took a very clear position that in contrast to the situation in the UK, they do not recognize plausibility as a distinctive legal concept or a specific patent requirement under the EPC, but rather they describe it as a generic catchword seized in the jurisprudence of the boards of appeal. So, and they bring as examples that plausibility is a term that, I mean, of course, enablement, inventive step, as I discussed it there, it plays a role, but also it could be whether if you file an experimental report, whether that is plausible, or if you look at a witness statement, whether, you know, the statement or the argument is plausible. So kind of back to the roots of the literal meaning of the term plausible. With regard to the core of the case, so post-published evidence and the plausibility requirements, here the board now, the enlarged board uses pretty generic language that will serve as guidance for the future, but which it deliberately kept relatively broad. So here the board concludes that there are not these, in their opinion, not these three buckets of cases, but they've analyzed all the cases and see that the core issue in all of these cases rested with the question of what the skilled person using the common general knowledge understands at the filing date from the application as filed to be the technical teaching of the claimed invention. And they say that all these cases that were cited by the referring board have one common ground, and that is that in all cases, the issue would have been what was or what was not derivable for the skilled person from the application documents. As I said, the plausibility issue here in the case at issue arose under the inventive step criterion for the technical effect. But, and that's interesting, the enlarged board in a relatively detailed obiter dicta also comments on the situation for sufficiency of disclosure. And again, I've put here the kind of the background when, right, a case, when plausibility arises under inventive step and when under sufficiency of disclosure. But if you compare the wording that the enlarged board uses for the standard under inventive step and the standard under sufficiency of disclosure, you will see that the standard for sufficiency of disclosure seems to be more strict. So here you heard in the slide before, it was something about derivable from the application. Here the board says, for the sufficiency of disclosure, it is necessary that the patent at the date of filing renders credible that the known therapeutic agent is suitable for the claimed therapeutic application. And because it is so important, it also makes sense perhaps to really read the verbatim language in reason 77 of the decision to the sufficiency of disclosure standard. And here the enlarged board states that the scope of reliance on post-published evidence is much narrower under sufficiency of disclosure compared to the situation under inventive step. So it's a different standard. And then they elaborate on that, saying in order to meet the requirement that the disclosure of the invention be sufficiently clear and complete for it to be carried out by the person skilled in the art, the proof of a claimed therapeutic effect has to be provided in the application as filed, in particular if, in the absence of experimental data in the application as filed, it would not be credible to the skilled person that the therapeutic effect is achieved. A lack in this respect cannot be remedied by post-published evidence. So that is a difference in the standard, right? That here we speak of proof, so at least some sort of proof of concept data, not necessarily in human data, but proving the therapeutic concept need to be included in the application as filed. Okay, and that brings me to the head notes. The first one regards the free evaluation of the evidence point, and I already read it out to you before. But the second head note is perhaps more important, and that is that a patent applicant or proprietor may rely upon a technical effect for inventive step if the skilled person, having common general knowledge in mind based on the application as originally filed, would derive said effect as being encompassed by the technical teaching and embodied by the same originally disclosed invention. So that's the catchword and sentence that you will need to reread and reread again, like the Oracle of Delphi, and apply to your case. Interestingly, the enlarged board in the final paragraph of the decision itself acknowledges that it has worded this very broadly and not particularly specific. But the reason for that is, of course, that this question of plausibility, like we saw in the In re Wands criteria, depends really always on the particularities of the case, so also the technical field, in question, and that's why it's difficult to make general statements here. Yeah, so in summary, the enlarged board has made strong statements that the free evaluation of evidence is considered a fundamental principle before the EPO. It has acknowledged that in principle you can rely on post-published documents in support of a technical effect. And then this headnote, which will become the kind of the new language or wording that you need to subsume your case under, that a technical effect can be relied on if the skilled person can derive said effect as being encompassed by the technical teaching and embodied by the invention as originally disclosed. The decision again makes very clear this distinction between inventive step and sufficiency of disclosure. In particular, that sufficiency of disclosure is a requirement that the application needs to fulfill at the time of its filing date. And that's also the reason why there's a more strict standard as to whether or not you can use post-published or post-generated data to support that. But then I think that's the most important point of the decision, is that the decision made clear that plausibility is not a separate criteria in addition to the known criteria that the EPO applies, but rather, as it says, a catchword that comes up in a lot of scenarios. So in summary, our take from the decision is that it certainly has not raised the bar on plausibility. So that was something that I think many feared. In our opinion, it rather leaves more room for debate. And it will be very interesting to see how the case law applies the new standard. You will get the full slide set here. We analyzed the cases that have issued to date. So a lot of cases were stayed pending decision on the G2 of 21 referral, and these now get summoned to oral proceedings and then decided. And so far there are 13 decisions citing G2 of 21, of which six substantively assess plausibility. And as you see, in many cases, plausibility was then acknowledged also specifically for functional antibody claims. So this is just one example you can read up in the slides that you will get, where we have a claim broadly functionally defining two kind of antibody components, a VISTA antagonist and a PD-1 antagonist for use in treating cancer, where in neither of these is defined by structure. And here the board applied the principles of G2 of 21 and considered the plausibility requirement to be fulfilled, in particular because the application disclosed screening assays for identifying VISTA antibodies. And the only other case I just want to point out to you is actually the referral case. So the case that led to the decision G2 of 21, right? That there the board now needed to apply the principles, and actually the oral hearing already took place in June 2023. And we right now do not yet have the decision of the board, the written decision, but the communication and also the minutes are available. And you can see that Mr. Müller and his board are not very satisfied with the enlarged board having rejected their kind of legal structured approach. And they openly admit that at the time of the hearing, at least, while they conclude that the plausibility criterion is fulfilled and they will take the data into account and ergo also acknowledge an inventive step, you see from the communication that they are not sure exactly what reasoning they shall put forward in that regard, right? So here in point 5.1, the board states, at this stage, the board is not in a position to conclude which of the two interpretations set out above is the one that most likely reflects the intended meaning of the expression in G2 of 21 as being encompassed by the technical teaching and embodied by the same originally disclosed invention. So it will be very interesting to read the recent decision here of Mr. Müller and his board on the referral case, which hopefully will be available soon. Yeah, with that, I think we can close and enter into the discussion part. Maybe just a note, if you haven't yet registered, we also have a case law webinar for life science and chemistry cases coming up in December. And also as a general note, if you would like to stay up to date or receive invitations for our webinars, please register for our seminar list. Okay, with that, I think I can stop sharing and enter into the questions. We have a question by Martin Quanz. Thank you for that. Regarding the difference, in fact, between plausible and credible when assessing if a technical effect can be taken from the application as filed. Yeah, that's something I noted from reading the decision, that actually when the board discusses enablement, they use the term credible and not plausible. And they also speak of this proof of the technical effect, which is a much higher standard than plausible. So in my opinion, I mean, CJ, you can comment as a native speaker, but credible is a higher standard than plausible. And proof certainly is a higher standard than plausible. So our interpretation is that this was a deliberate choice in wording, and that the board wants to make clear that for example, second medical use cases claiming a certain technical effect or medical utility, it needs to be not only plausible, but credible. And again, it's sometimes a complicated concept, but this plausibility hurdle is just the initial hurdle of whether you can, you know, get your data in. Once your data is in the proceedings, you still need to overcome a much higher hurdle, namely to really demonstrate that the technical effect is credibly achieved across the whole scope of the claim. But indeed, with regard to sufficiency of disclosure, the Enlard board uses these terms already regarding the requirements set for the application as filed, right? Which is different than from the inventive step situation.
Yeah, I think you're right that there is a difference between credibility and plausibility. At least from my perspective, credibility would be a higher standard, and plausibility just means to me it passes the laugh test. You know, you wouldn't see it and immediately think, now there's no way. Credibility, though, it seems to turn the burden of proof shifted a bit.
Yeah.
And require a higher standard of proof. And listening to your presentation, it was very interesting to me, having considered the WANS factors and thinking about this from an enablement perspective and how things overlap, because it seems to me that this derivability type of a standard, it implicates things like predictability in our system and also the amount of direction that the specification provided. So we're talking about similar things, but we're using different words and different concepts ultimately. So it's interesting to think about how things are different and how they might overlap as well.
Yeah. No, certainly. And the question that I had for you that fits maybe better now that you heard kind of about this situation here in Europe is this question about post-filed data, right? So actually this whole G2 of 21 decision, while it's instructive for sufficiency of disclosure cases, it actually dealt with the question whether you're allowed to rely on post-published data. Is that ever a question in US cases, or is there a similar standard, or is it usually possible to rely on it, but then it doesn't help because the criterion is that the application is filed should render it credible? Or
in the United States, there is a limitation. You cannot use post-published data to show a novel effect, mm-hmm. right? So it's very nuanced. And so like you have now in Europe, it is also nuanced whether you can use post-published information or not. But I don't think that issue has been fleshed out in the United States nearly as much as you were just explaining with this line of cases.
Yeah. Okay. Are there any other comments from the audience? As I said, feel free to raise your hand, then you will be elevated to a participant status and can also enter the discussion and switch on your microphone or video. Happy to hear your thoughts on the decision. Also, whether you think it's justified for the Amgen Sanofi case, I always can understand both sides kind of, right? That of course, claiming such a broad scope also blocks a lot of development if then, licenses are not easily obtainable. Yeah. On the other hand, at least, for example, in Germany, there's a clear line of case law and understanding that it depends on your contribution. If you were the very first person to have, found a PCSK9 antibody and shown that it has such a great therapeutic utility, then you're also able to claim that broad scope. So I can expect that there are many different views on this topic and the decision. Yeah, there are no further questions. Yeah, maybe just one comment from my side. We are often asked whether following this Amgen Sanofi case, whether in Europe generally such claims would be allowable. There's actually one interesting newer case that will also be in the slide material. I didn't show it now due to time aspects, but that concerned an antibody claim that defined a split epitope. So an antibody binding to an epitope that is defined by two separate loops. So the claim read an antibody, any antibody binding to loop one and loop two of this antigen. And that was then actually revoked for lack of enablement but it was a specific situation that the EPO then said the application does not disclose screening assays, how you would be able to screen for antibodies binding to two separate loops, right? Because it's not so standard to make the construct for screening so there the applicant should have described in more detail, how you would be able to find also alternative antibodies fulfilling that functional feature.
Yeah, no, that's actually a very good point. And I like that very much, because when I talk with inventors and we're trying to figure out how to draft the application, I ask them to give me as much information about invention as possible. And so something like how you would do that particular assay would be very useful in that kind of a context. But I also want to hear from inventors their attempts that failed, because that can also set the boundaries for the invention and help us figure out exactly how to describe it and how to claim it. And so when an examiner comes back and says, well, your claim covers everything under the sun, we can say, well, no, actually, we have limited it. And we have examples in our specification, in our disclosure, showing that certain things do work and certain things do not work. And we have described this in the claims to only cover the things that do work reasonably. Yeah. And we've excluded the things that don't.
Yeah, that's a very good piece of advice there. Yeah. Okay, then I think if there are no further questions, then I thank you all for attending this webinar and the interest in the topic, and you, CJ, for presenting the US side of things. Yeah, and I look forward to seeing many of you, hopefully also in person again sometime soon, and have a nice evening. Goodbye.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Stay informed at kohaus-florak.com/blog.